It is 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We're coming to on Monday afternoon. I'm already in the middle of the week, and I better get myself straightened out here. It's 2:06 on Monday afternoon. This is Political Rewind coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. My good friend and wingman on this show, Jim Galloway, the AJC political writer, is with me. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, and he oversees the AJC Political Insider blog. Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Welcome to baseball season. We won't tell you what channel they're playing, but the Mets and the Braves are at it right now.
Oh, my God. That's
and the right. Legislature's gone.
That is good news. And we're joined today by a very special guest. It's a real pleasure to welcome former retired U.S. Congressman Lynn Westmoreland. Lynn, thank you so much for being here. We should tell everybody you served six terms in the United States House. You represented that whole area down there, the 3rd District. It was the 8th District down kind of the middle of Georgia, you know, yep. Columbus and the area all around Columbus. So you're now about 4 months into, not that you're retired from business, but you left the House.
Yes. I feel like I'm still in rehab. You know, I mean, it's been, it's unusual to get up and not already have your day planned for you and somebody, you know, waiting to pick you up. So, yeah, we've enjoyed it. My wife and I are getting to know each other again, and
You're learning how to drive a car?
Yeah, I'm learning how to drive. I am. Believe it or not, I know it sounds crazy, but it is scary. It really is.
So we'll call you a recovering member of the United States Congress.
Yeah.
We've got a lot that we want to talk to you about in terms of your work and your perceptions of what you're watching going on up there in Washington. And so Jim and I are going to do that for a while today. But let's go back, if you don't mind. You decided that it was time you'd had enough. You had done six terms in the state legislature,
yes, sir,
and then gone to Washington, six terms up there. So you had a long tenure as an elected official in legislative bodies. And then you decided it was time to leave. Let's go back and look at why you did that.
Well, if you go back to our founders, they said you had to be 25 to be in the House. You had to be 30 to be in the Senate, 35 to be president. They never mentioned term limits because the life expectancy, I believe, was 47 at the time. So they figured you were going to term limit yourself. Mm-hmm. And I don't think our government was ever intended for somebody to be up there 50 years. And I've seen that happen. I saw the Georgia legislature where a lot of these guys, especially on the other side of the aisle, had been there for 30, 35, 40, 45 years, and they didn't have a bench. I mean, you know, we had a bench, and they didn't.
Yeah.
And I think they're paying for that somewhat right now. And so when Matt Collins decided to run for the Senate, I decided then I was either going to move up or move out.
Yeah.
And so basically the same thing. I mean, I had a real dear friend of mine die and another one that went through a serious illness and just kind of woke me up. 12 years is a long time. You know, you go to school and, it seems like forever to get through the first grade through the 12th grade.
What are you leaving that you really, really enjoy leaving behind? I mean, what's the worst part of being a member of Congress? Is it the fundraising? Is it being locked in that little room?
The fundraising is terrible. We need to do something with the fundraising laws. I mean, we need to do something with that. And I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, when you spend every, you know, a day a week trying to raise money, it's not fun. The other thing I don't miss is sleeping on a pull-out sofa.
Mm-hmm.
I don't miss...
You never had an apartment in D.C.?
I did the first 4 years. Mm-hmm. The last eight, I was in my office.
Yeah, we should. But, you know, let's talk about that just briefly. People may or may not understand how many members, especially in the House side where you're serving two mm-hmm. years, do sleep on their sofas and they shower at the congressional gym. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly a glamorous lifestyle.
It's more well. It's an up up.
No,
it's,
not only it's, that, it's, just it's having to look at those guys every morning. Yeah.
Well, it's an upscale YMCA.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, no, I mean it's a nice facility. Don't get me wrong, right. But it's still a gym. But I guess in Rayburn, I guess there was a total of about 35. Maybe 40 that did it, and it was fun. I mean, it was kind of, you know, down there every morning you saw the same guys, and, you know, Democrat and Republican. I was right between two different Democrats, and but hey, we made friends down there, you know, and talked, and it wasn't bad. It's just aggravating, you know, have to get up and get dressed and go down there and get undressed, yeah. You know, but.
You know, though, you're on to something that I think is an interesting aspect of the job. This unbelievable two-year treadmill that you're on. You no sooner win election or re-election than you're immediately beginning to look at raising money for the next campaign. Mm-hmm. You are spending maybe flying into Washington on a Monday afternoon, maybe Monday night. You're going to have votes on Tuesday. You try to get out on Friday. You're back in the district where you're not really home with your family. Oh, you're out doing constituent services work. You're having town meetings. You're meeting with people. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that for people who think this is a job that is, as I said before, glamorous, it's not.
No.
And that's not to say there aren't extraordinary things about the work you get to do, but it's a tough life, especially for a member of the House.
You know, Bill, I've got to do things that I would have never in my life I would have gotten to do and meet people that I would have never gotten to meet. And being on the Intel Committee was the most exciting thing, I think, being on that. But like you said, when you go to get on that jet leaving Atlanta, and there's a delay, and I've learned all about Delta. When they say, you know, it's a mechanical delay and it's going to be an hour, you might as well go home because it ain't going. And I love Delta. But, and the nights that I've spent at Reagan, you know, didn't want to call staff to come get you and not, you know, you're going to have to be there at 6 o'clock the next morning anyway. So, yeah, getting on that airplane and doing that is not very good. And people, I think the other thing people don't understand, when I first went up there, Joan and I had an efficiency, and it was $975 a month. And at the end of the fourth year we were there, it had gone up to $1,675.
Yeah. So, Jim, we know the job was there was a lot of, you know.
It's not something I do.
Yeah. All right. So, but should we ask the hard question? Should we just get the big question out of the way?
We'd wait till later.
No, we'll do it right away. So Lynn is suggesting that maybe he got out because it was time to give someone else a chance. It's an exhausting job. He was ready for something else. But, Jim, there are many people who speculate there was another reason he may have left when he did.
Yeah. Look, we've got a disease kind of circulating through the state. It's called gubernatorialitis, and now we need to find out who's got it and who doesn't.
Yeah, I don't have it right now, and I'm not going to say I'm.
Are
immune.
You vaccinated?
I'm not going to say I'm immune to it, but right now I. The one thing I've learned is that, and especially in politics, you can't let somebody else's decision influence your decision. And I think when Brian came out.
Secretary of State.
Brian Kemp came out. Everybody hit the panic button. I mean, my phone lit up.
We should just tell people. Kemp announced immediately following the end of the session late last week.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. He announced and. When he did, everybody hit the panic button. And I'm not ready to make that decision yet. I mean, it's about 20 months until the election. And I understand that you know, everybody wants to get out first. Everybody wants to get people committed. But at the same time, I'm not ready. I mean, the stars just haven't aligned for me to be able to do that. I'm happy. I am really and truly
But, well,
happy.
I tell you what, on that point, walk us through the checklist, the don't want to, do want to checklist that you've got, that anybody in your position might be doing right now.
Well, I think when you go down the do checklist, is there really things that you want to accomplish in the state and you just don't want to be governor? And I think that's one of the things that you have to get straight in your mind. And there are a lot of things that I would like to accomplish in this state. If we don't get our youth straight, in our prisons straight. And I think Nathan has started a good job on that. But that will need to be completed. And that's one of my big things, is that prison reform, the inner city kids. And when I say inner city kids, a lot of people don't realize we got inner city kids in Grantville. I mean, we got inner city kids in LaGrange. It's not just the kids in Atlanta or Decatur. It's a lot of these small towns, and that they really don't have the same resources as they might have.
So forgotten kids more so than inner city kids.
Absolutely. I mean, just in fact, we're right now beginning the process of setting up a charity with the campaign funds that I had left to do something about that.
How does that operate for you? What does that mean doing?
Well, your campaign funds, you can...
No, I don't mean that. I mean, what do you target in an effort to help young people in neglected areas?
Yeah. Well, I think what you have to do is there's a backpack where these volunteers make up backpacks for kids that take home for the weekend, make sure they have something to eat, you know, something to drink, something to wear, and a little gift, you know, a little something that they get. So I think you could expand with that. Mm-hmm. Then I think communities in school, that you could go to them and say, look, I know that there's somebody here that wants to play on the sports team that doesn't have the money. Or I know somebody that wants to be in a band, but he can't afford or she can't afford a musical instrument. And then there's two, there are times where I think they need mentors. Mm-hmm. I think they need, my philosophy is that if we can help somebody see what it's like to live outside their environment that they're in now, it may make them go, you know what, that's the way to go.
If you were going to decide that you wanted to run for governor, one of the things you would focus on is how do we work with disadvantaged youth? And I'm assuming you're at the very beginning process of thinking about how that works beyond whether you're going to actually run for governor or not. You'd flesh that out a bit. What's the process of figuring out whether you want to run?
Well, first of all, it's your family. And, I told Joan, we probably talk about it at least every other day, and you know, your wife doesn't like people to say bad things about you. I mean, you know, after you've been in politics for 24 years, you get a little tough skin and try to keep a tender heart, but you get the tough skin. Your wife and your kids never get over it. I mean, they get very upset about it. So I've got 7 grandkids now. And, you know, I don't know anything else they could pull out. I mean, I've said some dumb things. I've probably done some dumb things. But people already know that. I hadn't done anything any dumber or said anything any dumber than I have. And so, you know, so that doesn't bother me. But your family has got to be bought into it.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you know, is life itself I turned 67 yesterday, and so by the time this election would come around, it'd be 218, and or 2018, and you know, if you were fortunate enough to win, I would be 72. And so I don't know how many more years I got. And the 24 years I spent in government were really the money-making years of right. my life. And so that's one of those things that you have to think about, you know. But I love public service. I, honest to goodness, love helping people.
You know, it's funny, Jim. I remember when Lynn says that, I remember Sam Nunn making a comment about that casually when he finally decided to retire from the Senate. And he basically said what Lynn Westmoreland, he said, it's time for me to make a living for mm-hmm. my family. Yeah. And he did a very nice job.
Yeah, he did pretty good. Okay, let me ask you. Okay, this is not in the realm, but if somebody said you could be governor without having to run for governor, would that be tempting?
Well, it would certainly make some of the decisions different. Do you know anybody, Jim, that's going to do that?
Are you starting to – are people coming to you? Are the Casey Cagles and the others coming to you who are looking at making the run that we expect they will and saying, Lynn, it's time for us to get real here. Are you going to be in this thing? Are you starting to have those kinds of meetings?
I've had four of those calls. Yeah. And I've talked to each one of them and told them that I wasn't ready to make a decision, but I respected their decision, and that if I did run, that we were going to end up being friends.
Okay. So. All right, look, thank you for taking on that big question. Jim and I, we've known you for so many years. We figure we can ask you that harder question first. Yeah. But let's move on when we come back. We got to get in a break. But there's so much to talk about in terms of what's happening in the news right now. We are really eager to hear your take on what's happening in the House Intelligence Committee right now, having been a member yourself. We want to talk to you about how the Trump administration, in your opinion, is handling its first couple months in office. So much more. So we're going to be back, Jim Galloway and I, with former Congressman Lynn Westmoreland. It's 2:23 in the afternoon. We'll be back in a moment.
I'm Robert Krolwich from Radiolab. We're told that smell triggers memory. So if you're in your car, roll up your windows and inhale. What do you remember? Like the smell of a favorite dog jumping in the back seat long ago? A diaper moment, perhaps? There are some memories you cherish and others that just linger. How about contributing this barrel of aroma to your favorite public radio station? And you might even get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind on Monday afternoon. I'm joined, of course, by Jim Galloway of the AJC and our special guest in the studio, former U.S. House member Lynn Westmoreland. By the way, tweet us. We're starting to get tweets in today at PoliticsGPB, especially if you have questions that you think it would be really interesting to hear Lynn Westmoreland respond to. Let me give you a couple quick headlines, and they'll lead us into our conversation, I think, with Lynn. Democrats announced a short time ago, Charles Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, that Democrats have now pulled together enough votes to sustain a filibuster of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Mitch McConnell, of course, majority leader, says one way or another they're going to confirm Gorsuch by the end of this week. You know what? Let's just stop and talk about that for a minute. Lynn, what do you think about this notion that Democrats – let's talk about this in terms of a strategy. Is this a smart strategy for the Democrats to filibuster and therefore push the majority leader into exercising what we call the nuclear option, confirming a Supreme Court nominee with a simple majority?
I don't know that Senator Schumer has really thought this out, because – Gorsuch is replacing Scalia. So the balance of the court, in fact, he won't be as conservative as Scalia was. So making him go nuclear with this when the thing is will just be back in the balance that it was is crazy. Now, the next one, if there is a next one, that's when the court would tilt. And so I think that they're really making a mistake right now because of, I think the public's tired of it. And, you know, we've been saying, at least I've been saying this for the last 6 or 8 years, is that you don't know how many votes it takes in the Senate because they got such rules. And, you know, so, I mean, I just don't think the Democrats need to make that play right now. Strategy-wise, I just don't think it's right.
Yeah, in essence, I mean, the nuclear option means the Senate would be operating roughly along the same lines as the House.
Right.
With a 50% plus one majority where they rule. But I would think as a former member of the House, you might like that because it would be, I mean, because the Senate would no longer be that cooling saucer.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. I do. I think it should be 51.
Well, you know, let's, okay, so I want to ask about that in a second. But so, Jim, let's remind people as we have this conversation, because apparently the Democrats are going to force the Republicans to this point where they say a majority vote to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. And that's all it will be, is to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. It doesn't extend to the broader rules of the Senate. Well, we should point out it was the Democrats, when they were in control, who did the same thing when it came to federal judges, because they were dealing with an intransigent Republican majority. And so the Democrats, with an intransigent Republican minority. And so they pushed through the nuclear option in that case. So here we go, Lynn. It's back and forth and back. And you already said the public is tired of it.
Well, they're not actually changing the rules.
Right.
They're changing the precedent.
Right.
And the Senate precedent's a big deal. I mean, we go by rules, you know, but they go by precedents. And so it's a complicated procedure that they have to go through to do it. But they're actually not changing the rules. They're just changing the precedent.
Okay. So. Okay, fair enough. We should also, I would think, Lynn, point out that there's a lot of talk up there now about the observers of Washington is, oh my gosh, we're changing the nature of the Senate, as Jim pointed out, this cooling saucer. And although it wouldn't apply because, as you point out, this is a change in a very specific procedure, we shouldn't forget that it was filibusters which stopped the Civil Rights Act from being passed in 1964 for a terribly long time. So this notion that, the filibuster is some sanctified instrument,
it's sacred in the eyes of the employer, is what it is.
Well, remember, it used to be 75.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they reduced it to 60. You know, somebody asked me, said, well, you know, do you think Republicans will ever get 60 members, so this filibuster wouldn't happen? And I said, well, you're not thinking straight. You would have to have 80 Republicans to get 60 votes. Because, I mean, you know, the Democrats stick together. I mean, you know, you take the 60 votes they got on Obama, the Affordable Care Act. But Republicans don't do that. I mean, they don't stick together.
Well, if you don't mind, let's kind of pick up on that topic, because that's actually one of the big developments of last week. You had hints from Donald Trump saying that he would reach out if he couldn't come to terms with the Freedom Caucus, that he was going to reach out to Democrats. Mm-hmm. You know, Democrats are rather skeptical. But then you had Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, saying, no, we need to stick to this system that we've got where everything is decided within the Republican caucus, and it would be a great mistake to do that. I'm guessing you would back Ryan on that.
Yes. I like John Boehner, and a lot of people just didn't understand Boehner, but he got to the point of he was tired of fooling with it. Mm-hmm. And so he would go to the Democrats and get just enough votes to pass something, you know, 218, 219, mm-hmm. or whatever it was. Because once you get that balance of 218, you want to have the vote that second.
I mean,
you want to call them to the floor and go, hey, we're fixing to vote. I got the votes. Don't want to let one fall this way or one fall that way. But what these hardcore people don't understand, that they're going to pass the must-pass bills. They are going to govern, and they will have to weaken that bill continually to be able to get enough Democratic support. Now, they're not going to try to get all of them, but they're going to try to get enough of them and weaken or make the bill less conservative and more progressive to get it done. And that's what some of these guys don't understand. And I don't know. It just, to me, they're defeating, they're cutting their nose off to spite their face.
And but now, what would be, okay, I understand that, yeah, you'd have to make a bill maybe a little less, quote, conservative. But what would be the wrong, is there something philosophically wrong with reaching out to Democrats?
I mean,
other than Republican primary.
No. I mean, look, I've got David Scott's one of my best friends up there. I mean, mm-hmm. he and I have worked great together on issues. And
he was up there for Sonny Perdue and testified for Sonny Perdue two mm-hmm. weeks ago.
So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just that when you make a lot of campaign promises, you feel like you need to keep them. Let's take, for instance, if you don't mind, the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace. They locked down, the House Freedom Caucus and probably some others locked down on it. When Trump started compromising with the House Freedom Caucus, he started losing the Tuesday group.
Yep.
The moderate Republicans in the conference.
And the Tuesday group is a lot bigger than the
What are the numbers?
Tuesday group's probably 60.
Okay.
But there's some Democrat and some Republican in that group. Here's what I don't understand. If I had been a Freedom Caucus guy, we elected the American people elected a Republican president based on his campaign promises. If I had been there, I would have said, look, I don't like this bill. This bill's flawed. And if this was the final bill, I would be voting no. But because of what we promised the American people that we would repeal and replace, I'm going to vote for the process. I'm going to vote for mm-hmm. this to go to the Senate.
Just to move it.
Because I've been there 12 years. I've never known the Senate to go, oh, look, here's a House bill. We're going to go ahead and pass it.
Yeah, but that's a slightly disingenuous?
No, not really.
Because what you're suggesting is you can go back to your voters and say, I voted for it. No, blame it on those members of the Senate.
No. What I said is be upfront. Say, look, I don't like this bill.
Okay.
I think it's flawed. But I'm going to vote for the process to continue
and
see what the Senate does, because you already had Portman, Susan Collins, Rand Paul, Cruz. I think there was about seven of them that had already said they were not voting for this.
Yeah, for this, and some because it wasn't conservative enough. And,
exactly.
And others because it was too harsh.
You got Susan Collins, Ted Cruz, two entirely different reasons, I'm sure. But they'd already said that. So the risk of it going over there and getting passed was zero. But that way, it took the pressure off of the House, and it would have allowed it to heal some. But now that thing, the line in the sand is just deeper than ever. And why not put the pressure on the Senate and let Trump deal with them?
With the Senate. So let's continue this conversation, because it takes us into an area that you were very involved with, which is redistricting.
Yes.
When you were up on the Hill. And here's where I think this is interesting. The Freedom Caucus was able to maintain its opposition to the bill, and despite the fact that President Trump mostly after they weren't able to even vote on it, threatened to go into their districts and primary them. The reality is redistricting and gerrymandering has pretty much
made... Now, I didn't have anything to do with that.
No, I know that. But the point, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know
the fact of the matter is, President Trump may want to go in and take some of those folks out, But gerrymandering has essentially set up districts where you are completely safe, or as close to safe as you can be, as long as you hew to that conservative line
right,
that
yeah,
your
these,
voters
yeah,
in
these,
the district
these,
want,
these,
right?
Yeah. These, well, free, yeah, these Freedom Caucus members are only threatened if somebody runs to their right.
Right.
And Donald Trump can't run to their
no,
right.
That's no, that's right.
Here's, you know, there's probably about 40 districts that you could really consider competitive. And they're in probably half of those are candidate driven.
This,
you know?
This is out of 435.
That's correct.
Right.
And so you've got that to deal with. I just think it was silly for the president to come out and say that. Now, I do think it was smart sending Pence into Kentucky and talking. He may should have gone to Ohio and talked. But, Jim, you're right. They're not, you know, they're not going to beat these guys at home just on Trump saying he's going to run somebody. Now, you know, if he, I don't know how they're going to do it, but there's, you know, you need to study the districts and say, okay, most of these guys ran ahead of Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody likes their congressman, right? I mean, you know, that's well. I mean, that's. I mean, you know. I mean, they, you know, everybody else in Congress is a slob, and a wasteful spender or a progressive.
No, no. Look, Tom Price ran what 12 points ahead of Trump.
24.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, let's ask the big question. How is Trump doing? It's been a rough couple months, hasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of that's been self-inflicted. I think he's made some tremendous cabinet appointments. You know, Tom Price lives and sleeps that Affordable Care Act. I mean, he's one of the hardest working people that's ever been to Washington, D.C. And so in Pompeo, I served with him both on the Benghazi Committee and on Intel, number one in his class at West Point, a Harvard lawyer. Had two or three successful businesses. So, you know, and I like Tillerson. I think Tillerson is a common factor, calming in the fact that he doesn't get all worked up like Kerry did. And I think that's good for Secretary of State.
Despite the fact that he was the subject of a piece in Politico Profile, they got a lot of attention this past week, saying that he takes his private elevator to his office, doesn't want to talk to people in the State
Department.
Oh,
I didn't see it.
And that, you know, this is one of those stories that has anonymous sourcing, so you take it with a grain of salt. Nevertheless, it got a lot of attention all over Washington. People have been instructed not to talk to him as he passes them in the hall. And what I think goes a step further, and you really have to be a little skeptical of, people have been instructed not to look him in the eye. Unfortunately, because
nuts.
He has been so quiet and kept himself so isolated, it makes it more delicious for some people to think all of that might be really happening.
Well, Bill, let me bust your bubble.
Yes.
There are members of the House
that
will not let their staff talk to them. Only one person can talk to them. The Senate, if you're on the Senate side, a senator.
Those are demigods, aren't they? Are they not?
The staff can't even ride on the elevator with them.
Yeah. Not demagogues, demigods.
And same thing, you know, a car on that little train they got over there, staff can't get on it with them. In the House, we invite staff to get on with us. One time I was in the Senate, and I had a couple of my guys with me, and there were some staffers standing there in the elevator, and they would not get on. I almost had to physically drag them onto the elevator. But they don't speak to senators walking down the hall.
All right, so let's go back. So, okay, you think that he's made some good cabinet appointments, but as you look at the 2 months and the one controversy after the other, the ongoing Russia connection that we want to talk to you about. You mean, this has so far, there's not going to be at 100 days, which is coming up in like 28 days now. It's like April 29th.
Yes, that's right.
Is 26 days. This is not going to he's not going to have a lot of achievements to show for his first 100 days, is
no.
he?
No. But, I mean, I think Donald Trump, if he knew what he knew a year ago of what he knows today, I don't know. I think he may have dropped out. Mm-hmm. I really do, because I don't think he understands the complexity of the legislative body. I think that he right now he's using Pence as, you know, the attack dog or whatever you want to say for the vice president. I don't think he's using Pence to his fullest potential because of Pence's relationship with the House and the Senate and his advice on governing. You know, you look at his cabinet appointments, and not a lot of them have a lot of political experience. And I think he is on a he's on a learning curve. But when you're president of the United States, supposedly the most powerful man in the world, that's no place to learn.
And so what you're saying is that Pence ought to be something of a Secretary of Congress.
Yeah, I mean,
if you will.
No, I think I just don't just think
somebody to just to be the person in upgrade that liaison function.
You know, Joe Biden played a big role mm-hmm. in negotiating with the
right.
Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Pence came from the House. He was a RSC chair, very conservative guy. I mean, and you know, I just don't think he's being used to the full potential. I think he's using him to, okay, Mike, you run over to Kentucky and make a speech, or you run over here. And you're finding Trump kind of in the same place Obama was at, really. Obama loved to get in the shirt sleeves and get up in front of a friendly crowd. That he loved that. Because I don't think he really knew how to govern. And Trump feels more comfortable out campaigning and being in front of that friendly crowd than he does doing the things that it takes to get your legislative agenda passed.
We have to take another break. It's 2:44, and when we come back, I want to talk Devin Nunes.
Yep.
I want to talk a little bit, Jim, about a report that came out in Bloomberg today that suggests there may be more to this notion that there was some Obama administration involvement in unmasking people who were caught in incidental collection of intelligence data. We'll talk about all that with our guest representative, former Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, after this.
On the next Fresh Air, it's tax time. While many people are still trying to finish their taxes, the Trump administration is trying to move forward on the president's promise to overhaul the tax system. We'll talk taxes with journalist T.R. Reid, author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. Join us.
Fresh Air, this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Lynn Westmoreland, you were on the Intelligence Committee. Who was chair of the Intelligence Committee when you served on it?
Mike Rogers and then Devin.
Okay, so you did work with Devin Nunes.
Devin was also on the committee while Rogers was chairman.
Right. So help us, given that you have a personal relationship with him, you've known him, and you also understand the way in which the House Intelligence Committee operates. Has Devin Nunes gone completely off the reservation, or are we misunderstanding something about the rights that the chairman has to do things like that?
I like Devin's a good guy, and Devin takes intel very seriously. When we had the Benghazi attack, I was the subcommittee chair of Oversight and Investigations. We started at that point trying to get Chairman Rogers to let us bring some people in and look at this. It was really a State Department issue, which we really don't have any control over. That's you know, Foreign Affairs that oversees the State Department. But we felt like that these GRS guys, these, you know, the guys that actually save the folks, they are contractors of the CIA. So we felt like we had...
You had a foothold.
Yeah, we had a foothold that we could get them in. And I think Rogers was kind of letting Foreign Affairs, Armed Services, and really government oversight kind of deal with it before we got involved. Devin actually met with some of those GRS guys. Mm-hmm. And he would do that and actually come back and tell the chairman, I met with these people. This is what they're saying, you know. So he's one of those that really wants to get to the truth and to the facts and stuff.
Should he have gone over to the White House?
Well, Michael Ellis was our legal counsel, and he is very, very, very smart. I didn't know that he'd gone to the White House, but he's probably as bright a lawyer, especially when it comes to the intelligence and all the laws that go with it. Because you got to remember, he helped us write, you know, the Intel bill, the cybersecurity bill. I mean, he pretty much knows all that stuff. I think he's the one that called Devin and said, I've got some stuff you need to see. Well, you know, and I think they went over there. I don't know what kind of information it was that they couldn't have had it at the Capitol, but I don't, like I said, I don't, you know, I've been to the room over at the White House, you know, before, so I don't know what kind of technology they got that we don't have. But Devin, I would have personally told him he needed to tell Schiff.
The ranking member, the Democrat who was number one Democrat on the committee.
I mean, I think he should have told Adam. I think that probably somebody in the White House should have gone to the president and said, can I brief the Gang of Eight on this?
Well, in a sense, that's kind of what they've, in a backwards way, they finally invited Adam Schiff over to the White House.
But, but you had this awkward scenario where Nunes goes to the White House to get the secret information, goes back to the Capitol, holds a press conference, and then goes back to the White House to brief Donald Trump on something that his own staffers had just fed.
So let's give you a news update on all of this, because we all know this started with President Trump tweeting out that he'd been wiretapped by Obama. Bloomberg just reported today. It's called Bloomberg Views. It's, you know, it's, these are essentially op-ed pieces with, of course, some basis in news reporting and news collection. And here's what they posted today. Eli Lake. White House lawyers last month learned that the former National Security Advisor Susan Rice requested the identities of U.S. persons in raw intelligence reports on dozens of occasions that connect to the Donald Trump transitioning campaign, according to U.S. officials familiar with the matter. What that means is, according to this report, when we say Susan Rice requested the identities, she was asking for the unmasking of those names. Typically, if you're caught up in incidental collection, you are identified as U.S. number, citizen number one or whatever. Mm-hmm. According to Bloomberg today, Susan Rice asked for those names of Trump people to be unmasked, and Trump sees that as vindication for his tweet, although a lot of people who are reading this news say, not quite. It's disturbing in some ways till we get more information on this.
Oh, absolutely. And Bill, remember when Flynn, when it was the transition team, Flynn was in Trump Tower. That's where his office was. So they picked up this data from Trump Tower. Now, that doesn't mean that Trump Tower was wiretapped. It means that they picked him up on some of this surveillance. And the minute you pick up an American citizen the second you identify as an American citizen or just somebody in the United States. They don't have to be an American citizen. You have to stop surveilling. If you want to surveil them, then you have to go to the FISA court. Now, in the FISA court, it depends on what kind of evidence that you've got to produce and what kind of evidence you have to produce. But typically, Bill, that's not really, in some instances, it would create an unmasking if they already knew that there was something mischievous in the works so the FBI could watch them. But unless it was something like that, even to get the FISA, they wouldn't unmask who it was.
Let me ask you, just the fact that this is that Susan Rice's name has popped up here, is that going to be a red flag? I mean, just given the kind of the crucial role that she played in the your Benghazi hearings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, if I didn't learn anything in 24 years, I learned the cover up is worse than the crime. And if they're trying to cover something up, I'd surrender. I'd just come out and say, look, let's get it all out. Because as this thing comes out drip by drip by drip, it's only going to make people more skeptical of what the truth really is.
But now let me ask you, we do have some people saying that the House Intelligence Committee has pretty much put itself out of the game with all these maneuvers, and that really the Senate Intelligence Committee is the only congressional investigation with clout right now, that and the separate FBI agent. You're rolling your eyes here.
Yeah, I am. The Senate would like to think that they were the only intelligence committee. But I think if you listen to Schiff yesterday, he softened up a lot. I mean, it wasn't the same kind of talk he had been doing the day before. So I think that if anything, they could say that Devin made some bad decisions in the protocol of what he would have done.
Well, so even if he did make bad decisions in the past, the future lies ahead. And
sure,
he has canceled the only hearing scheduled,
mm-hmm,
including canceling an appearance by Sally Yates, Atlanta's Sally Yates.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no House intelligence investigation, at least right now. And we don't know when Chairman Nunes is going to bring that committee back together and actually have
true
the hearings that he talked about,
true,
right?
And I don't think we will, Bill, until he sits down with Adam,
okay,
and straightens out that. I mean,
let me give you some breaking news. It is not at all surprising. The Senate Judiciary Committee has sent Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court nomination on to the full Senate, voting 11-9 on a straight party line vote. So sets it up. There is talk,
mm-hmm,
that tomorrow morning Mitch McConnell is going to bring Neil Gorsuch's name in front of the full Senate. We'll hear. That's going to be exciting to watch.
The Democrats can make it have a 30-hour window for debate.
Oh, yes.
So
sure.
Now it would probably be Thursday before they vote.
Before there's any vote.
Yes.
But presumably McConnell is going to present it tomorrow.
Yes, yes, sir.
Let's talk Georgia we only have a couple minutes left. We asked you earlier on about your potential to run for governor, and we'll watch how that develops. Can Georgia go blue in 2018? You've got every constitutional office in the hands of a Republican. Did you see any signs in the 2016 elections that could change anytime soon? Demographics are going to change, but is it going to happen in 2018, 20, 24? When is it going to happen?
You know, Bill, that's a great question. I think you're going to get a good indication of what happens in Georgia 6. I mean, you got the Democrat at 42%. He's been running a smart campaign. I mean, if you walked up to the person on the street and said, is he Democrat or Republican, you might not get an answer. You've got 15 Republicans all calling the same few people in Georgia that give money, and so they don't have enough money to hit him and, mm-hmm, to really bring out.
Yeah, which is why the NRCC has come in.
The NRCC has come in with a $2 million buy, and so we'll see what happens there.
NRCC being the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee.
Yeah. And so here's the problem, though, and this is what I've been screaming for 2 weeks about this. I said, y'all don't get it. This guy gets in the runoff. Every Democrat in America, if not the world, is going to send this guy money.
Well, he is going to make the runoff, it appears, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, unless, you know, unless he gets hit by a car or something. I mean, right. Nobody mm-hmm. wants that. But, I mean, you know, he's going to be in the runoff. And so the money, and they're going to use that as a launching pad for Montana, South Carolina,
yep.
Kansas. And they're going to say, see, we can do it. You know, here.
Sounds like they're doing what Lynn Westmoreland did, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
All right. I would love to pursue that. We are completely out of time. Lynn Westmoreland, it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you should come back.
And I will.
Let's just talk politics, regardless of whether you're going to be if you become a candidate, we cannot have you on.
Yeah.
But if you decide not to run, we would love to have you come back in here. Of course, it's great to have you, Jim Galloway. And I'm glad you mentioned the 6th District race right at the end there, Lynn, because on Wednesday, we're going to devote a good portion of our show to talking about the 6th District race. And one of these we're really looking forward to is Buddy Darden. Our good friend Buddy is going to be back on the panel on Wednesday. And I asked Buddy to go back and take a look at the jungle primary that he ran in 1983 when they had a special election.
I covered that race. I did too.
The 7th District race that he won in a special election. And Buddy's going to share stories about that race. And we'll talk about how that compares to what's
now,
going on.
When's he
going to
be on?
Wednesday at 2.
I'll have to listen.
All right. Lynn Westmoreland, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being here today. Politics GPB, tweet us and follow us at that handle. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again on Wednesday.